The second presentation is by Mr. Dimitris Triantafylopoulos, Professor of Byzantine Archaeology in the Department of History and Archaeology at the University of Cyprus. Mr. Triantafylopoulos is a distinguished scholar of Byzantine Studies and Byzantine Archaeology and formerly served in the Archaeological Services. His writings are distinguished by their theological foundation. Any theological school would count it a great gain to have Mr. Triantafylopoulos. The Department of Theology here in Cyprus, however, has won him over. He has also worked on studies concerning the environment, and it was from this perspective that he approached the writings of St. Joseph the Hesychast. Today, he will speak to us about the understanding of creation and material things. Thank you. According to Elder Joseph the Hesychast. Thank you. So then, my dear and beloved friend, come, even if only for one day, so that we may speak of God and theologize together, so that you may enjoy what you have been longing for and hear the wild rocks, the mystical and silent theologians unfolding profound meanings before you, and guiding your heart and nose your spiritual intellect toward the Creator. After springtime, it is beautiful here from Holy Pascha until the Feast of the Most Holy Theotokos in August. The beautiful little rocks and all of nature are theologians, voiceless theologians, each speaking through the voice of its silence. If you touch a tiny blade of grass with your hand, at once, it cries out very loudly through its natural fragrance, "Oh, you did not see me, but you struck me." And so it is with everything. All things have their own voice, and when the breath of the wind sets them in motion, they become a harmonious musical glorification of God. What more can we say of reptiles and winged birds, since that saint sent his disciple to tell the frogs to be silent so that they could read the midnight office? They answered him, "Have patient endurance until we finish matins. Your eminences, holy abbots, reverend fathers, elders and eldresses, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chairman, you forgot the most important thing, that we come from the same homeland and have been friends since childhood. Thank you for your kind and flattering words. The passage I have just read to you is, unless I am mistaken, the longest text in which the blessed elder speaks about nature as God's creation. The gulf between this and the language of secular ecology is immense. Secular ecology replaces the Creator with his creatures and even if unwittingly makes gods of them. This is neo-paganism. Having no share in theology or monastic assises, I am wholly unfit to speak on the weighty subject that the fatherly love of my elder in Limassol instructed me to present before you. And please, do not take this as false humility. As I read in the bustle of Athens this summer the books about Blessed St. Joseph the Hesychast, graciously presented to me with noble courtesy by the Reverend Abbot of the Holy Monastery of Vatopedi, Father Ephraim, to whom I offer my heartfelt thanks, I was filled at once with admiration and catanixis, with compunction at the true spiritual stature of the elder whom we honor, but also with panic at the thought of what I could possibly say about him. These feelings have only grown stronger over the past few days. I say this to prepare you for what follows, and I ask your forgiveness beforehand. The passage we heard is neither a treatise on nature nor some mystical hymn addressed to nature after the model of St. Francis of Assisi. It is simply an elder's letter to a priest, written in what the world would call an uneducated and misspelled manner. I would cite similar passages from the Conversations of Blessed St. Paisios of the Holy Mountain, were I not addressing Athonites and friends of monasticism. We are speaking of people who live far removed from even the smallest comfort that we seek as we run breathlessly after consumer goods. The Kavsokalivites seem utterly incomprehensible to those of us trapped in our false self-sufficiency, unable to understand that non-possessiveness is the ballast of the balloon. The less you carry, the more easily you rise to greater heights. As the elder's illumined disciple, the Blessed Joseph of Vatopedi, emphasizes, his teacher did not pursue non-possessiveness as a self-contained virtue, but as a means of attaining evangelical freedom from care, as liberation from the tormenting search for material things. St. Joseph, the Hesychast himself, writes with admiration these simple words, filled with spiritual fervor about another ascetic of his time, Father Daniel of St. Peter the Athonite. His daily divine liturgy always lasted 3.5 to 4 hours. His tears would always soak the ground before him. For this reason, he did not want anyone present at his liturgy, lest they see his spiritual labor. He ate 25 drams of bread. He says, throughout his liturgy, he was entirely suspended above the earth, and he would not finish the liturgy until the ground had turned to mud from his tears. thanks to the illumined biography written by his likewise divinely enlightened disciple, we know of the elder's unceasing and painful ascesis, which he did not abandon even when he left his hut, built of mud brick against a cave, and settled at New Skate. He did so only after yielding to the pleas of his fellow monks, who saw how the hardships were worsening his health. Here, then, is the first lesson for our subject. The elder chose not to use any material goods beyond those provided by his immediate surroundings, only what was absolutely necessary and handmade. Nor did he undertake any construction that was not strictly necessary and that would distract him from his daily ascesis. His biographer vividly and humbly recounts the lesson he received from the elder when, through demonic interference, his well-intentioned effort to build him a basic wood-burning stove came to nothing. The relentless question was, "Why are you making us so ugly?" This question concerns us all. The elder gives us a second lesson by distinguishing destructive obsession with work, even when well-intentioned, from the absence of ascesis. This ascesis is not understood as ceaseless overactivity that ultimately leads into worldly bustle, devoid of hesychia, inner stillness. The Western model of the hyperactive individual stands at the opposite pole from the monastic ideal and is strongly condemned by the elder. Let me read you a passage. "Today we hear nothing said about such things because people have been so overwhelmed by many cares and material concerns and have come almost entirely to despise spiritual things. Thus, many not only refuse to investigate, learn, and put these things into practice, but if they hear anyone speak of them, they immediately rise up against him and regard him as irrational and foolish because his manner of life is unlike theirs, and they take it as a reproach to themselves." And so forth. I shall abbreviate. Second, as we have seen, the elder was by no means unmoved by non-rational creation, yet he knew how to order things rightly. Even though we do not see him absorbed in descriptions and hymns celebrating nature, his attitude toward God's creatures, both animate and inanimate, was governed by St. Isaac the Syrian's definition of the merciful heart, a heart burning for the sake of all creation and every creature. From the many-sided and edifying volume of talks by Father Ephraim, abbot of the Holy Monastery of Vatopedi, I cite these remarkable words. "He saw God everywhere. He respected even non-rational creation itself and regarded it as a means of glorifying God. Through long ascesis and the indwelling of divine grace, he had acquired senses trained in spiritual discernment. And through God's exceedingly good creation and the beauty of created things, he was raised toward their supremely beautiful Creator. We therefore stand before a third lesson, the Eucharistic and doxological use of creation as opposed to its misuse by the distorted domineering will and greed of autonomous, self-absorbed, and darkened man. With such an attitude, the elements of nature, the animals, and humanity do not struggle against one another. Together they glorify God, the giver of every gift, as is portrayed so expressively in depictions of the praises in the main churches of monasteries." This is not a figment of the imagination. We learn it from the lives of the saints. Our elder admired his contemporary, the strict Hesychast elder Theophylactos, who lived at the Hesychasterion, the hermitage of Saint Artemius, and healed the bear, treating it as though it were a human being. Blessed Amphilochios of Patmos, his compatriot, often said that whoever does not love trees does not love Christ, and all of us have either heard about or personally witnessed the peaceful coexistence of human beings and animals, even animals normally harmful to us, in the huts of ascetics of our own time. Yet for the Christian, this post-fall world is only a station along the way. This does not mean despising it, but placing things in their proper order. We know of no martyr or saint who preferred the beauty of this world to the radiant beauty of the Holy Trinity itself, hence their frequent visions of paradise and their unquenchable longing to pass as soon as possible from here to the world beyond. Similar experiences of our elder are widely known, so I shall not recount them. I would emphasize, however, that this ascetic of little formal education, who continually withdrew into silence, described his visions with extraordinary vividness. The intensity of his vision transformed even his language. This is not uncultivated speech, but language transfigured by the grace of God. We have passed from the beauty of language to the language of beauty. The fathers know nothing of ecology, but only of God's creation and his creatures. They neither make them autonomous nor divide them into fragments, but approach them as a whole and bring them into unity. I therefore use the word ecology only in an extended sense. Let me first recall the two broad areas with which ecology is concerned, the natural and the built environment. if the commemoration of a saintly figure can offer us steps by which to ascend in our spiritual progress, we must ask ourselves this question. If the elder were living today on the holy mountain, almost half a century after his falling asleep on the very feast of the Dormition of the Theotokos in 1959, yet another heavenly blessing for which he had longed, what might he show us and teach us through his way of life? It is a difficult and inescapable question demanding both courage and humility from us all. Let us briefly look back at history. At the beginning of the 1970s, the number of Athonite monks began to recover, now including men with university degrees, while idiorhythmic monasteries gradually returned to the cenobitic life. After the restoration of democracy, a senior official in the government of the time expressed the intention of turning the holy mountain of the Theotokos into a model tourist and museum complex. The plan, initially secret, also called for clearing land, building dams and heliports, establishing an extensive network of land and sea transportation, and constructing breakwaters, along with rapid, large-scale restorations or complete renovations from the foundations upward, and much else besides. In short, it envisioned a drastic and irreversible intervention in both the natural and built environment of the Holy Mountain. When the plan was exposed, it provoked a storm of protest, and this, I remind you, at a fiercely anti-church time because of the hierarchy's stance during the dictatorship. The plan appears to have been shelved temporarily. Yet, as early as 1977, the late Philip Sherard, by then long Orthodox and already the author of two excellent books, one on the Holy Mountain and the other on Constantinople as a sacred city, warned with deep sorrow about the abandonment of Athos's 1,000-year-old footpaths and their replacement by paved roads. As he emphatically stressed, this meant replacing pilgrimage as a process of inward maturation and spiritual conversion. With voracious superficial tourism that is often indifferent to religion, he himself chose never to make another pilgrimage to the Holy Mountain. I should note that he fell asleep in 1995. His reaction seemed extreme, almost irritating. Even recently, a Western writer criticized him for holding a Western understanding of pilgrimage, only to observe with good intentions on the very next page that today there is an ever-growing tendency toward commercialization in the garden of the most holy Theotokos. Greece's entry into the European Economic Community in 1981 brought a flood of money to the Holy Mountain as well, transforming it into a strenuous, noisy construction site and a destination for mass tourism. Only the day before yesterday, we once again heard here in Cyprus the astonishing proposal, born of ignorance of the realities, for religious monastic tourism. Venerable monks such as Blessed Saint Paisios of the Holy Mountain and the learned Father Moses. Here among us, theological giants such as Bishop Callistos Ware of Diocleia, along with countless lay people, increasingly perceived a new danger that the means might become an end in itself. Indeed, many lay people, and certainly monks as well, believed Saint Paisios's grave warning that this uncontrolled obsession with work would soon cause immense harm. His warning was borne out in the early 1990s by the successive disasters that struck Mount Athos. And of course, that was only the visible side of the damage. The elder was more deeply concerned that monks might devote themselves ever more to the internet than to the one phrase Jesus prayer. If I am exaggerating, please forgive me. This is what I have gathered from reading on the subject, and I am utterly unworthy to criticize such spiritual athletes. I am simply repeating the judgment of their fellow spiritual strugglers. Nearly 10 years ago, in 1996, His Eminence Hieronymus of Thebes and Livadeia convened a large conference at the Holy Monastery of Hosios Lucas. It brought together scholars from various disciplines to discuss the use of churches as archaeological monuments. At the time, a bitter dispute between the state and the church was raging, and most archaeologists wanted worship removed from these ecclesiastical monuments. Naturally, the discussion also sharply raised the issue of museums housing ecclesiastical objects. It is unfortunate that, as far as I know, the proceedings of that conference were never published unless they were published without my knowledge. But I will summarize several contradictions that were noted and discussed at length then, and which continue to concern us. First, the Church rightly insisted on the sacred character of its churches, yet many were quite willing to adopt state measures for generating tourism revenue from them. Second, as a rule, and rightly so, as Papa Diamantis also passionately insisted, the Church rejected the existence of state-run Byzantine museums, since sacred objects are thereby secularized. Today, every metropolis, every holy metropolis, has acquired its own museum, which it hastens to advertise and from which it may also collect revenue. Did the end justify the means, or did the secularization cease simply because these museums are called treasuries or sacristies? Third, the Holy Mountain never considered sending sacred relics abroad to raise money or to exhibit them, except for alms collecting or processions, in times of dire need, or for the healing of prominent persons. Even an elementary understanding of what a museum and an exhibition mean should be enough to keep at least the monks constantly on their guard against this kind of exploitation. Museums and exhibitions in their modern form arose in the age of the Enlightenment precisely to strip sacred objects of their sacred character, especially after the French Revolution, and to establish museums as temples of art in place of temples of worship. In 1997, the great exhibition of the sacred treasures of Mount Athos was held in Thessaloniki. And since then, from time to time, these or other treasures have been carried the length and breadth of the earth. Allow me to be somewhat categorical. Do you know of any non-Christian or heterodox Christian who converted to Orthodoxy because he saw icons at an exhibition? Did such conversion not generally take place after an experience of Orthodox life and worship, especially through pilgrimages to Mount Athos and to monasteries more broadly? We all know the deeply moving accounts of the latter, but do we have testimonies of the former? Can anyone imagine the departed Papadiamantis, Moraitidis, Kontoglou, Theotokas, Penzikis, Lorenzatos, and so many others speaking convincingly about Orthodoxy merely through their aesthetic experiences at an exhibition? Fourth, what exactly does the modern church understand by ecology, especially now that it has recently given it official recognition by observing it at the beginning of the ecclesiastical year? What does it mean for the human person to be a priest of creation rather than a merciless exploiter of nature? How far does the Creator God's declaration that creation is very good extend, and where does humanity's demonic use of nature begin? If the Church does not embody this difference, who will? But which Church? For we are all the Church. The Church of those concrete, extravagantly luxurious monstrosities which repel you even with their supposed imitation of the Byzantine style or their copies of Hagia Sophia, buildings that provoke only pity and the ridicule of those who truly understand. What sense of measure do they serve, when their builders have not learned even the elementary difference between a Byzantine church and a Gothic one, a difference that is precisely a matter of measure? Has no one in Cyprus read Seferis's fiery poem about Saint Neophytos, which begins emphatically by condemning the ostentatious architecture of the foreign heterodox Franks? As for the many contemporary monasteries that try to impress with all kinds of perfectly appointed facilities and social work, lest we find ourselves confronted with Western monastic orders of the Counter-Reformation. No one says that some of these things are not needed. But can anyone imagine Elder Joseph spending his sacred hesychia, his inner stillness on such pursuits, or, still more, planning and pouring concrete as the handiwork of monks? Are we to regard such activities today as remnants of an age with a very different ethos, an age when restoring monastery churches and monasteries was not a matter of spending allocated funds, but of humility, begging for alms, and praying for the salvation of those who offered donations and those who labored with their own hands? And are the thousands of tons of irreversible materials, concrete, plastics, and so forth, that are slowly suffocating even the Holy Mountain really the proper response of the Church to the worldwide problem of air pollution? In one of his last books, The Overflowing of the Waters, the late Nikos Pentzikis spoke prophetically and warned, "Fewer today are those who go to Mount Athos, moved by the love of beauty and lifted up to divine love. He knew and lived these things infinitely more and far better than my humble self, and he needs no defense from me. I only wonder, are new monks still coming to Holy Mount Athos in the same growing numbers as before, or has their number declined? And if, contrary to all hope, God forbid the latter is true, should we not all ask ourselves why? To sum up, by bringing the city into the monastery, we solve no problem. On the contrary, we make everything worse. Until now, the monasteries have done the opposite. They have tried to transplant the spirit of the monastery into the city." Thus, to recall the apt phrase of Mrs. Eleni Glikatsi Arweiler, they sanctified every corner of the Byzantine world. Otherwise, the Lord's inexorable words stand before us. If the salt loses its savor, how shall it be made salty again? The alienation now evident among spiritual elders, as the respected Father George Metallinos recently observed, is one of the most ominous signs for the Church. What I am saying may perhaps sound like untimely zealotry or an unrealistic nostalgia for some lost paradise of old Mount Athos. but allow me to recall what the late Father Alexander Schmemann wrote in his deeply moving journal. The uniqueness of Christianity lies in the this-worldly character of the transcendent and the transcendent character of this-worldliness. And what is always at stake is the human person. Ascesis, ascetic discipline, simplicity, and the renunciation of non-essential things are an urgent duty for us all today, especially as the hole in the ozone layer, larger this year than ever before, gapes like a gigantic mouth of Hades ready to swallow us all. It is said that during the Clinton administration, when the Kyoto Protocol was under discussion, the president suggested that Americans turn down their air conditioning by 1 degree, which would have brought about a substantial reduction in pollution and energy consumption. His proposal was rejected on the grounds that it violated individual rights. In other words, this was the nightmarish absurdity of a monstrous egocentrism. I do not think the messages conveyed by the impressive exhibitions of Byzantine sacred treasures in New York, praised with good intentions by everyone, were of any benefit at all. Today, America is being struck by the worst hurricanes, while the insatiable demand for raw materials leads on childish pretexts to one war after another. In conclusion, as he brought the discussion to a close at the conference held by the Holy Monastery of Atopedia on St. Gregory Palamas, Callistos, Bishop of Dioclea, stressed that we live in an age which has forgotten that nature is sacred, that it is a gift from God and a means of communion with Him. St. Joseph the Hesychast lived this every day, not only by praising the works of God, but also by putting Assisi into practice and renouncing all that was non-essential. And of course, this is not a concern only for the monk. If today we are holding a conference about the Hesychast in a hotel with every comfort, let us at least remember, as lay people, the example of Papadiamantis, who refused to go to the splendid hall of the Parnassos Literary Society where King George was to honor him, because he experienced Assisi differently in his exceedingly humble one-room dwelling amid the Babylon of Athens. Both he and our elder followed the centuries-old tradition of the ascetics before them in the deserts and the cities. I say all this first and foremost as an effort at self-reproach, and please forgive me. May the prayer of the elder shelter us all. At the outset, I suspected that this panel and this session featuring non-theologians would be especially interesting, and I think I am beginning to be proved right. I would also like to emphasize the theological approach taken by our dear speaker, who is also from my own region. He said that himself. I could not say it because there were others on the panel and I did not want to slight them on that account. I will not go on thanking him. We should also note that although some of us may hold different views on some of the things he said and may disagree, and we have every right to do so, it was clear that his words arose from deep concern and a heartfelt sense of pain. My dear Dimitris did not treat these matters superficially. I cannot fail to note the precision of his speech, his masterful use of the Greek language, and the eloquence and beauty of expression he has shown us. Something I believe that our age greatly needs. We thank him for everything.